And that's some of the news for Tuesday, April 5th, 2022. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York City. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.
The previous program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio coming up. It's 6:30 p.m.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion. This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Ailey Slane and Matthew Kearney. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. Now, Elise is not here this week, but she will be back next week. And what we're talking about this week is Don't Look Up, the movie that has been released on Netflix. It is by far the most prominent climate change movie that has yet come out. Who we have with us this week is Jack Baldwin, frequent contributor to this show. Jack happens to be an expert on film, published expert on film. So, Jack, welcome to the program. Tell us what you think about Don't Look Up.
Thank you. First of all, there are many good and some great things about Don't Look Up. The best thing about it is that no movie I've ever seen has captured so well what I feel as a climate activist trying to get a message out to the world that the world doesn't seem to want to hear. But though I liked Don't Look Up quite a bit, it's a flawed film. Now, in my lifetime, I've seen very few unflawed films, but in this case, the movie's faults don't strike me as insignificant. Here are four things about the movie I didn't care for. At nearly 2 hours and 20 minutes, Don't Look Up is much longer than it should be. It could easily have been a half hour shorter than it is. The character of the black scientist, Dr. Teddy Oglethorpe, played by Rob Morgan, is outrageously superficial. Although portrayed as smart and professional, which is positive, Dr. Oglethorpe, unlike the other characters, is never granted a private life by the filmmakers. At the end of the narrative, he winds up at the house of Dr. Mindy, the Leonardo DiCaprio character, as if he had no family of his own and nowhere to go. To me, this was offensive and annoying. Three, the politically incorrect astronaut Benedict Drask, played by Ron Perlman, a character which seems to have been inspired by the late John McCain, doesn't work on any level. Perlman is mostly an embarrassment, though the fault lies, I suspect, with the script rather than with the actor. And there are logical inconsistencies as well. For example, Kate, the character played by Jennifer Lawrence, is captured by federal agents and forced to sign a document in which she essentially gives away her free speech rights. Yet later she joins the Don't Look Up movement against the president, violating her signed agreement, and suffers no consequences for this at all. Strangely, however, most of these faults haven't even been mentioned by the negative critics. They've been so busy bashing writer-director Adam McKay and the author of the original screen story, David Sirota, for their perceived intentions that these glitches have gone unnoticed. Though the film has had its champions, including Manola Dargis of the New York Times, many critics seem to regard this movie not as an imperfect satire, but as something unclean that must be rejected in toto. In their dismissals of this film, smug is one of the words most often used by these reviewers. Indeed, the word smug often appears in the headlines of these reviews, such as this one from Time magazine. Quote, Adam McKay's Don't Look Up buckles under the weight of its smugness. While the Columbus, Ohio-based publication Alive employed the headline, Don't Look Up and the Insufferable Smugness of Being. While in the body of the review, the critic opined that if the world is indeed ending, there are better ways to spend 2.5 hours than sitting in a theater under a crashing wave of smug self-satisfaction. Well, I think it's these critics, not the filmmakers, who are being smug and self-satisfied. In place of smug, I think the word desperate should be substituted as a more accurate description of the filmmaker's tone. I see this movie as a Hail Mary pass thrown by a progressive filmmaker hoping against hope to change the conversation about climate change. Astonishingly and happily, McKay succeeded. In the week ending January 2nd of this year, Don't Look Up broke Netflix's record for most viewing hours in a single week, with a whopping 152.29 million hours watched globally. It was also, judged by its first 28 days of release in comparison with the identical period for other Netflix films, the third most watched movie in the history of the streaming service. We'll speculate on why the movie is so popular a bit later. To get back to the criticisms, some critics made the lame argument that a big comet hurtling towards Earth is a less than perfect metaphor for climate change. I mean, like, duh. Of course, climate change isn't like anything that's ever happened, so it can't really be compared to anything. Thus, no metaphor for this crisis could possibly be adequate. On the other hand, as a pop culture trope, the fatal comet or asteroid plot is so very familiar because of movies like Armageddon, Deep Impact, and Asteroid versus Earth, to name three, that its cliches can easily be exploited to stress our ridiculously inadequate response to the present crisis. In that sense, McKay's comet as climate change concept is, in my opinion, absolutely brilliant. The most common and also, I think, most ridiculous charge against Don't Look Up, is that it's heavy-handed. If you believe, as I do, Bill McKibben's statement that the climate crisis is, quote, the biggest thing that's ever happened, how could any criticism or mockery of governmental inaction in the face of that crisis be too heavy-handed? And yes, the movie isn't subtle, but it's not so unsubtle that humor goes totally out the window. I probably have to concede, though, that there are things that I, as an activist, find funny, such as Jonah Hill's character's public prayer in honor of, quote, stuff, that a non-activist audience member might not find particularly amusing. Finally, where are the dozens of movies about climate change that this one could be negatively compared to? So in the near total absence of other such movies, shouldn't Don't Look Up be given the benefit of the doubt, at least to some extent? So now I'd like to engage Matt about this movie, ask him a few questions about it to find out what he thinks, and we'll have a little debate about the movie. So, Matt, what did you think of Don't Look Up?
In a word, I loved it. The more I watch it, I've watched it twice now, and the more I read about it and think about it, the more I like it and enjoy it. And it's usually the opposite with movies, at least since like 2000. And in this case, it's more engaging the more I'm into it. And that may have something, if other people are reacting the same way, that may have something to do with why it has so many viewing hours. As you mentioned, Jack, it's like leading Netflix for viewing hours. Let's make sure to state the obvious in case it hasn't quite dawned on everybody. The comet that's going to strike Earth and create an extinction level event, as they describe it in the movie, that's the metaphor for climate change. The thing that has a specific timeline that will for sure cause mass death after that timeline. And they make it clear in the movie, there's a pretty good shot at preventing this catastrophe that doesn't get implemented. You mentioned, Jack, that Dr. Oglethorpe is a more superficial character than the other characters. And I agree with that. It is striking that he doesn't bring anyone to the final gathering. You know, that is striking. And some people who are kind of married to their career might be able to identify with that, but they don't really specify that that's what his situation is. They just, you know, he's just sort of there on his own. But he is the guy who is there's a shout out to Extinction Rebellion in this movie. He gets arrested protesting against government inaction on the comet/climate crisis and gets carried away by police and is yelling, "We will not be quiet," as he's getting carried away by police. They show that in the movie. That's an Extinction Rebellion moment, straight up from a retired senior government scientist who quit in protest at the government inaction and starts to organize as an activist. And it might even be significant that they had the black male character being the one who got arrested. It's sort of the iconic image of civil disobedience in American history is black people being arrested and carried away by police. The movie is certainly preachy. And how do you not, if there are people who are denying a scientific fact and you want to tell them the scientific fact, how can you fail to come across as preachy? And maybe we need to figure that out. But like the simple declaration of a scientific fact that others are denying is inevitably going to strike some as preachy and smug. It's almost not a criticism to say that that's what happens. You are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM New York with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. Although Elise is not here this week, she will be back next week. Who is here is Jack Baldwin, who's an expert on film, talking to us about Don't Look Up, by far the most prominent climate change movie that has come out. It's a Netflix movie nominated for Best Picture.
Which jokes worked for you and which didn't?
Well, in a way, like, there are entire characters that are jokes. Meryl Streep as like the female Donald Trump with a tramp stamp is absolutely convincing. I couldn't believe it. It was completely different from how I'd seen Meryl Streep in any role before. And I haven't seen all of her movies, but I've seen quite a few. Like, my jaw just dropped at how completely convincing she was in that role. Jonah Hill as the male Ivanka Trump, who's a senior White House advisor and is the offspring of the president, and is just the most utterly materialistic, superficial, spiteful human being that you could possibly imagine. And the characters are so both out. They're like something out of absurdist theater. You know, they're so over the top, strange, and yet convincing in their strangeness that it's the ultimate in tragedy and comedy combined. You can't fail to laugh at them. But if there were a giant comet that was headed toward Earth and we all had 6 months or so to live, isn't this pretty much the way it would actually play out? Like, isn't the Cate Blanchett and
Tyler Perry?
Thank you, Tyler Perry. The Cate Blanchett and Tyler Perry characters. Isn't that a good example of like how news anchors actually would talk about it?
Yes, yes. News light, keep everything upbeat, keep everything fun. And that's an ironic message for a comedy, that not everything is funny and not everything can be laughed off. But that is his paradoxical position in the movie. And, you know, there's that great line where the Tyler Perry character says, "Will the comet be big enough to wipe out my ex-wife's house?"
Yeah.
You know, and that aspect of it, I think that the way the news anchors were portrayed, I think even the negative critics conceded that that was credible. So that's a commentary on the news media right there.
Yeah, the characters. So some of them do clearly represent quite particular things. I mean, Cate Blanchett and Tyler Perry standing in for television media, Ariana Grande standing in for celebrity culture, which she herself embodies merely yes. being an actress in the film. So the movie's very self-referential too. A lot of people have said that the way that Jennifer Lawrence character, Kate DiBiase, behaves in the media reminds them of Greta Thunberg. She's like without a filter, says exactly what she thinks and says it straight up. We're all going to die, delivering a message forcefully and directly that people are not prepared to hear and understand, and and gets marginalized substantially from the career trajectory that she could have been on as a result. Whereas the Dr. Mindy character, Leonardo DiCaprio, originally sitting there right alongside her, ends up being a lot of the scientific community. Really, it's a very fascinating trajectory that his character goes through.
Yes.
I mean, he ends up in the exact same place that the DiBiase Jennifer Lawrence character was, screaming on television, "We're all going to die," sitting in the very same seat that she was sitting in when she said it on the very same TV show.
Yeah.
But Mindy, in the meantime, he goes through all these things. He / the scientific community of climatologists think that they're doing the right thing by playing along and trying to fit their message in with the ruling class messaging. But the clock is ticking the whole time. And then the clock wound down.
That brings me to my next question. Did you identify with those two main characters, Dr. Randall Mindy and Cate DiBiase, to the same extent that I did? I don't think they're comic characters at all. I think they're dramatic characters and to an extent tragic characters.
Exactly.
So I was wondering what you thought of them, you know, overall as characters.
In a way, they're the only ones who aren't comic. I mean, in a way, the ones who are trying to stop the comet are the tragic characters. So Oglethorpe and especially Mindy and DiBiase. I guess in a weird way, that astronaut who you didn't feel worked at all from a completely different ideological and sort of rhetorical place, but still, like, he's in a position of trying to stop the comet. And he was actually set up to be the tragic character. Like, it was supposed to be a suicide mission, the one that he was originally on. So he would have been the literal tragic character. strangely enough. And everybody else is just outright ridiculous. I identified in some ways with the Mindy and DiBiase characters. You're trying to say something. Nobody's hearing it. Nobody's understanding it. Nobody's able to act on it. And I identified very much with everything they tried didn't work. And it's like with Extinction Rebellion, everything we're trying isn't working in the sense of actually reducing emissions. I mean, maybe it's working in the sense of raising public consciousness, as Mindy DiBiase Oglethorpe's work did in the movie, but it didn't work in stopping the comet. So we got more awareness of the destruction, but we still got the destruction. And that's pretty much what has happened with Extinction Rebellion so far.
I think what those characters represent for me, I mean, when they went to college, they didn't study, you know, Saving the World 101. Mm-hmm. You know, they're trained as scientists. They're not trained as, you know, do-gooders. They're not trained as messiahs.
Or as activists.
So they're given a degree of responsibility that ordinary people should not have to bear. It should be the political leaders and to some extent the media that should bear that. And as we see realistically in the film, none of them do bear that responsibility in the people in authority. I want to talk about the character, the billionaire Peter Isherwell, which I thought was brilliantly played by Mark Rylance. I thought that was possibly the best performance in the movie. I thought he was phenomenal.
He stole the show. And how can you steal the show with a cast of Leonardo DiCaprio, right, Jennifer Lawrence, Ariana Grande, Meryl Streep, Jonah Hill, Kate Blanchett, on and on and on and on and on. And he did. I had to look up who Mark Rylance was because I wasn't familiar with him. Can I just say, like, this guy was the founding artistic director of the Globe Theater in London. Right. For 10 years, he was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II for his contribution to theatrical arts. I mean, this is like one of the premier theater artists in the world, and I didn't even know who he was. He completely stole the show.
Well, he won the Oscar for a Steven Spielberg movie. I don't remember the name of it, or offhand, but he was an obscure English actor for a long time, and then he became a star actor in Hollywood movies. But his work in this was phenomenal. And the complexities of the character of Isherwell, it's almost giving too much dignity to the Elon Musks and Jeff Bezos of the world to have somebody like Rylance play them, you know, because Isherwell is a much more interesting person than they are. And because of his wealth and because of his tech skills, he's the epitome of a person who's all technology, no heart, no feelings.
Yeah.
And he's even able to predict people's futures. You know, he says that Meryl Streep's character will be, you know, he predicts her death. You know, so he almost has magical powers and he's able to order everybody around. So I think that was one of the most valuable services the movie did for people, is to debunk these billionaires and show what they're really like and where their power comes from and why they have to be opposed.
So for those who haven't seen the movie and don't quite follow what we're talking about, this character, Isherwell, is a tech billionaire. He's the CEO of a gigantic cell phone company. People have likened him to Elon Musk. People have likened him to Steve Jobs. People have likened him to kind of Google itself and the omniscience of Google, knowing everything about all of us, including the capacity to predict futures, as Jack pointed out. A critic brilliantly described this character as the omnipotent baby because he is totally emotionally underdeveloped. The way they play him, he's probably totally sexually underdeveloped. He's profoundly immature, and yet, like, there's a dash of real genius in him. There's an extreme tech savviness, but that's it. There's a perverted utopianism. It's not all about the money for him. He's not pure. I mean, he's motivated by money, but there is a little bit more than that. He thinks that he can make money in a way that improves the world. So he's not just Wall Street where he's purely stealing from people and only wants the bottom line and that's it. Yes. He's not Wall Street. He's Silicon Valley, and he is a baby. And he's omnipotent. And that's a brilliant read of so much of Silicon Valley. Absolutely brilliant.
I agree. I think McKay was very conscientious about trying to put in what we lose when the Earth is destroyed. There are a lot of seemingly extraneous shots of nature in the film, of flowers and birds and so forth, and all these shots, and to show us what we have and what we risk losing by this ongoing disaster. So I think that was more hard on the sleeve than Kubrick would ever be. On the other hand, you know, Kubrick's movie is obviously superior cinema to me anyway.
Yeah, but, I think so.
Yeah.
But those nature shots are great, and they are incongruous, and yet they're absolutely on the theme of what is being lost. Another way that McKay showed loss was by having sudden cuts. He would cut away from an actor speaking and go to the next scene before the scene was over. He would even cut them off mid-word sometimes. And it's a weird pacing of the film. It's a bit striking, but it shows end of the world, right? It can happen all of a sudden. And he'll even go so far as to take like powerful actors like Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio, who are in the middle of their fully emotional performances in their big speeches, and he'll stop them and suddenly cut away even in the middle of a word.
One thing that I thought was ironic is that climate scientists almost unanimously support this film, but their favorable comments have been ignored by reviewers, many of whom are critical of the fact that the movie depicts scientists being ignored. Okay, so the critics themselves are epitomizing this very same thing that they're criticizing the film for.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio, 99.5 FM WBAI with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. Elise is going to be back next week. We are talking about Don't Look Up, the, shall we say, analogy for climate change, allegory for climate change, a movie that most definitely engages with climate change, also has a shout out to Extinction Rebellion in it. Jack Baldwin is here with us, giving us his thoughts and having a dialogue about this movie.
We're going to introduce at this point spoilers into the broadcast.
Right. If you don't want to know what the ending is, now's the time to turn the volume down. And you can come back to the archived version of the show if you like. So we are going to talk about the ending now.
What do you think of DiCaprio's famous final line, which he supposedly, according to McKay, ad-libbed? We really did have everything, didn't we?
Well, it depends on what you mean by everything. I mean, the thing that's not right about it is there was a chance, like the movie makes clear, there was a chance that a combination of technology and heroism and human spirit could have stopped the comet. And it didn't happen. So we didn't have enough to make that happen. So we didn't have everything.
I interpreted the line as saying, you know, what a beautiful planet we had. And we screwed up, we messed it up. It's like the last line, you know, or one of the last lines, in the film Easy Rider from 1969, you know, we blew it. And I think that's what DiCaprio's line is saying. We have this great, beautiful planet, which we could have preserved if we had been wise, and we didn't.
Oh,
and, that's my interpretation of the line.
So then the past tense of had everything. Is oh gosh, you're gonna make me cry, Jack. Yeah, that's what. Okay,
but the thing is, it's like one of my favorite movies growing up was A Christmas Carol, and Scrooge at the end says, "Are these the shadows of the things that must be, or just the shadows of the things that might be?" I think McKay's film is the shadow of the things that might be. I don't see a path forward in the current political economic system where we can turn this around. On the other hand, so many crazy things have happened. So many inexplicable and unpredictable things have happened that there might be some kind of breakthrough. And there's bigger consciousness about, stronger consciousness about this problem than ever before. So, you know, who can say? All we have to do is keep trying, I think.
Has been extended.
Extinction Rebellion Radio.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing.
Testing.
Tune in to Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright on Tuesday, April 5th, 9 p.m. will be joined for the third time in a series with filmmaker Rosemary Reed about her distinguished filmography. This time we'll focus on Widow of the Revolution, the Anna Larina story about the young bride of Nikolai Bukharin, one of the principal leaders of the Russian Revolution. And Where Birds Never Sang, the Ravensbrück and Sachsenhausen concentration camps.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
I'll tell you again, but no more if it's brewed with fish.
Oh, fish. Yeah.
That's what they like.
Yeah, right.
James McIntosh, host of Mindfield, which comes to you every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse, family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties and your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Activist Sharon Salam speaks out for WBAI.
We should be moving forward, collecting the funds that we need to make sure that our station is whole and that it can do its job as it has done for me in the past. When all of this stuff happened to me many, many years ago in 1989, I didn't get very many opportunities to speak out in regards to the wrong that was done to my son and the other boys in the Central Park jogger case, as it was called at that time. Very few people stepped up. Yes, Like It Is was there. WBAI was there. And a few others. Majority of those stations that let people like myself speak and tell them what was going on the other side, those stations are gone. If we lose WBAI, where do we go to get our words out? Where do we go if you've been arrested unjustly? Where do you go if someone's taken your children unfairly? Where do you go to seek justice? We must keep this station alive. Yeah. Alive. WBAI.
No justice.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Extinction Rebellion Radio, heard Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI Evening News. Stay tuned for We Only Want the World, coming up with Sansara Taylor. And as we continue on with the broadcast day, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give